got to get clear about removing all that stuff so you can create the life you don't want to retire from. And when you do that, you've won the game.
Dude, time out. Too much. You hit so much. And I want to go back here for a second because...
So I was right about the retarded Tim Tebow thing.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Sanzano, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbagino. How's it going?
Jake, I'm doing great, brother. How you doing?
Man, I'm always making it happen. You know that. Today's guest is best known for his books, Killing Sacred Cows and What Would the Rockefellers Do? But we got a new book. We got a recent book, Money Unmasked. And in this one, he educates on how to, I'm going to get this right, Gino, unlearn, unlock, and take back control of your finances. So without further ado, Garrett Gunderson, welcome to the show.
What's up? Good to be with you guys. And you're having me back, so I didn't mess up the first time too bad. But now that I've been on twice, I think that it's just time to you know, go after you. That's fine, you know?
Straight up attack.
Gino said he had a bad day, and yeah. So I'm like, all right, let's do it.
Bring it, Garrett. On. He called me a retarded Tim Tebow, and I got to find God so far. So for the folks that are not on, you know, we missed that. But I'm gonna pull this out, Gino. Gino always says, hey, not everybody knows the guest. Gino says, warm them up. Rub them titties a little bit. Oh, we got to cut that one out. We're getting a little too far in this one.
It says actual recording is higher quality on my screen. Jake, do you believe that that's possible for you?
Man, here comes the question. So for the folks that don't know you, you got to give us a little background, yeah. Share with us your story and how you got started in the business, and then we can pick on Gino together because I already got mines.
I started making too much money doing finance, so I decided to be a comedian. You know, okay. Because every entrepreneur just has a dream to be up there and make people laugh while their money just goes away. You know, actually, I sold my business because I wanted to do comedy, and I'm using entertainment to educate. And that means I have a couple books coming up, Money Unmasked, that we talked about. I have one coming up that even Jake could read. It's called I Am Money. Because Gino did read my
not
book, Jake
true.
Didn't.
So not true. It's audible or nothing. So you're wrong. You're
well,
wrong.
Maybe you could have like your kids read this to you. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because it's pretty easy read, children's book. And did a comedy special called The American Ream. So I used humor to, I don't know, it's like 90% humor, 10% education. I didn't want to be too much of a pretentious prick and make people learn while they were laughing. But I did a little bit, you know, just a little bit. So,
you know, Garrett,
that's a little background.
Listen, I love the book. I read the book. And what I love about it, well, let me give you a background, everybody listening, about Killing Sacred Cows. When I read Killing Sacred Cows, I felt betrayed. And why did I feel betrayed? As I'm reading the book, I'm like, holy crap, everything I've learned has been a lie. I'm like, 401ks suck. 529s suck. Net worth is not the problem. Cash flow, sole purpose, abundance, scarcity mindset. I'm like, I felt like I was lied to. And that's when I latched on to the double G squared over there. I said, I love his stuff. I love this book. And when you came out with the second one, I recommend everyone, you know, run out, buy it, read it, because there's so many things in the book that you talk about from Killing Sacred Cows, but it goes into this book. It goes into deeper. And I think sole purpose. And I think as entrepreneurs, you say so in the book, all we're trying to do is grind, grind, grind. But we don't look at our optimum value. We don't look at other things in life. And we're killing our family while we're trying to grow. And it's like, let's take a look at everything holistically. What are the couple big takeaways before I start answering questions about the book that you tried really to get across to the reader?
That our relationship to money is really just a reflection of our relationship to ourself, and that we have these four money personas that we're going to fit into. And it's really the predictor of our success or failure with our finances. But unbeknownst to us, these are kind of the underlying forces that unless we recognize, we're doomed to make certain mistakes. And there's this flip side, which has to do with co-creation and collaboration and coming from abundance, where the winning personas exist, but they only win when they work together. If you're ever isolated and you don't utilize the others, you will limit your wealth and have a ceiling. And when you hit that ceiling, that's the ceiling of I'm grinding, I'm working harder, but there's only so hard you can work. And then life starts to suck. And then everybody tells you, no, just sacrifice. Because one day, someday, when you're way too fucking old to enjoy it, you can finally do the things you want to do. And that notion is garbage because it has us to destroy our life along the way. And so I go
through
everything.
That's retirement in a nutshell.
It's stupid, right? It's And like, look, I get it. My dad was a coal miner. Retire. That's a shit job. Coal mining is a shit job. And there's a lot of blue collar workers that are doing stuff that's breaking down their body they don't enjoy. But the way I would redefine that is get financially independent, get enough cash flow to cover your expenses, and then opt into a career of value creation consistent with your skill sets. And if you're financially independent because Gino's shown you how to get, you know, these apartments that are creating cash flow, then you have choice. But when people are deep into consumer debt, when they've went and got a college education, that the diploma's maybe as good as wiping your ass with toilet paper when it comes down to it, because you're woke and entitled when that's finished. And now you're stuck in this situation where you don't have a skill set that adds massive value, and you think someone's going to come and save you and offer you this high-paying job with benefits so that you could just cruise through life. Wake the fuck up. That story's been told, and it hasn't worked. And this book is about, look, when it all comes down to it, we have to love ourselves enough and see the skills in ourselves enough and invest deep enough in ourselves. And I give really practical examples of how you reclaim cash so that you can invest back in yourself and how you can profit from your ideas up front without having to borrow or invest a single dime. And ultimately, you've got to get clear about removing all that stuff so you can create the life you don't want to retire from. And when you do that, you won the game.
Dude, time out. Too much. You hit so much. And I want to go back here for a second because.
So I was right about the retarded Tim Tebow thing.
Dude, absolutely. Know? I gotta break this down because there's a similar, but there's like this psychological debt, a psychological void with these college kids. They're crushing them right out of the gate. So there's no hope. They're teaching them these crazy things that put them in this victimhood. They're strapping them with college debt. And social media is telling them they need Gucci by the time they're 19, and they're strapped with consumer debt. So by the time you're 23, you got no chance.
And the first 2 years of college are absolutely worthless. General education is so bad. And then what you said, that's a great point. I want to take a moment on that.
I made a comeback with him, Gino. Yeah. I'm on the right side.
Yeah, you are. You're like, you just threw a touchdown pass on this show. I'm about to pass. So. A lot of people have this notion that we're being educated, but you use the word indoctrinated. And the indoctrination goes like this. Really articulate writing with a faulty premise ends up creating people that are learned in a way that's not helpful. And that indoctrination says, yeah. And they say the more educated you get, the higher your income can be, your higher social status, which puts you further into indoctrination where you're not thinking for yourself, but regurgitating what Wall Street, Big Pharma, like we could go down the list, these major corporations that everyone in their right mind goes, those corporations don't have people's best interests in mind. Yet we give our lives over to those corporations where the entrepreneur and small business owner doesn't abide by those rules of fucking people over. They abide by the rules of value creation, and yet they get lumped into that system somehow and looked at as problematic by professors and, you know, PhDs. And whatever doctor that's just a customer service rep for Big Pharma, and we somehow think that this is the solution. No, the solution is we've got to invest in ourselves, think for ourselves, question the system, be infinitely curious, and then really dial in instead of saying, well, this person is an Ivy League graduate, so I should hand my money to them because they're going to know what to do. You know what they know to do? Study hard, pass difficult tests, and separate you from your money, because they're being taught not how to actually manage money, but extract value. And I know that's harsh, but that's what Wall Street has done. Name one positive movie, one positive article about anything that ever happened on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. That's why I felt betrayed, Jake. That's the betrayal right there.
There's more to this, and I want to break down this college stuff because they're educating these kids, making them feel smart, and they come out and they can't make money. So guess what? Their new social status is their wokeness, okay? Yeah. And that's like, I am so smart. I know this, that, and the other thing about how people should feel, this, that, and the other thing about them. And now that is all of a sudden, that is their social status on social media, this, that, or the other thing, because they can't make money. So now they're broke, but that's feeding the ego. And then all of it gets kind of drummed up furthermore on social media. So this is a real problem here. And
they
so
don't
I
know
just,
what profit yeah. is. They just know what a pronoun is. That's
yes,
it.
Yes.
But both of you are talking about it. There are parents out there. If you're a parent,
and let's hate on pharma
this,
for a second. I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up after this.
We can definitely hate on pharma.
F pharma, you know, and I used to work in pharma. And here's the thing. It was good when everybody hated pharma. Thank God Kennedy's out there right now because you know what?
Oh, he's trying to save the world, man.
He's trying to save the world. And it was a good thing. Like I was working there. I saw some, you know, shady shit. But ultimately, when the whole country is concerned with what pharma is doing and holding them accountable, that's a good thing for the country. When pharma aligns with the government and they are one entity, that's a big freaking problem, folks. And that's where we're at right now.
And how is it that people go, man, this opioid crisis, pharma was messed up. That is such garbage. Pharma.
Yeah,
and
but jab me six times.
But that's fine. I mean, I need 83 boosters. Yeah. I need another booster. Okay. Yeah, that's
Can
really
I get
healthy.
The next one with some oxy at least?
Thanks for solving our problem. Appreciate you. The good news, though, is I've learned who to be friends with and not be friends with externally, which I didn't know before. I see people driving around in a car with a mask on by themselves. I'm like, cool, we don't need to know each other. We never have to talk. I don't know what you're protecting yourself from, the air conditioner.
Well, because they're probably going to rob a store.
Yeah. Well, as long as it's in San Francisco and under $1,000, it's perfectly legal.
The parents, before I get into your book, the parents have a responsibility here. And you guys are both joking around. But if you have children going to college, you're making light of the situation, which I think is great because our kids aren't going to do that. I've homeschooled my kids. My kids go to college and they're still on the conservative side. So I've already taught them the values and the ideals that they need to do that they will not be indoctrinated by. So that's really important. The parents have an obligation and a duty to teach the kids their values. And when they enter college, even if they go, send them to junior college for 2 years, let them not pay anything, get a free ride for 2 years, and then go to get your bachelor's. But in the book, this is important because you talk about self-love and there's seven steps here on page 79, 80, and 81. This is probably the most important thing because love thyself, love thy neighbor as thyself, and that self-love's. I know Jake's gonna throw up and vomit and all, but it's so important to understand that if you don't have self-love, and I don't mean the kind of love where you're gonna bat yourself, I'm the best. Just understanding that you're give yourself a break, give yourself a chance, and it's all right. If you can't have that kind of love for yourself, you're never going to be able to love others, number one. And number two, you're always going to self-sabotage yourself. You're always going to say, that's not my true worth. I can't charge that. I'm not worth that. You'll have that money block, and your relationship with money will be totally damaged. I know the seven steps are long, but I really tell everybody, go on this because it's really about self-healing and working on yourself. And once you can correct yourself, if there's something – I'm not saying that everybody has problems, but whoever's listening to this and is struggling with that, the seven steps are really wonderful. It's a real, real great reflection upon trying to heal any kind of relationships that you have. And the first part about it is really taking responsibility. You want to add anything to that, Garrett?
Responsibility is the only way that we get through any of this. And we're in a world that's addicted to blame and victimhood. And so What's nice is when you add love and responsibility together, then you can say, look, I might make some mistakes, but let me be honest about it. So many people are in this pretense of acting like everything's okay when it's not feeling their own emotions, have a ton of self-hatred and frustration because they feel like they have to be perfect and act like everything's okay when it's not, and that they shouldn't speak up when they think certain ways because somehow that's insensitive to everyone else. And ultimately, when we stifle ourselves to that level, we lose this quality of vulnerability, which connects human beings. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really grow up with this map of like how to love myself. I really judged myself harshly.
Yes.
I mean, from the time when I was 3 years old, and I got hit by a car. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm going to the hospital. My mom's crying. My dad shows up in his coal mining outfit. My grandparents show up shaken. And at three, I'm like, man, if I'm not perfect, I'm going to hurt people. So I better be perfect, which puts on a lot of stress, and it's an impossible thing, which meant every time I was less than perfect, which is quite frequent, I'm hating that part of myself. And so we adopt these kind of beliefs. And then I once hired a consultant, and he's like, you're too authentic. You need to scale that back, because if you're in finance, you need to make people want to like think you know everything. And I was like, and what I found was the opposite to be true. The more I shared of myself, the more real I was, the more truth that I told, the more resonant the right people were. And the people that weren't, I was okay with that. Like At one time I did have a necessity to be liked by everybody that I had, and that people pleasing destroyed my life. Now I just want to like myself, love my family, and give love from a distance to people who are very upset, because I know when they lash out at me, it has nothing to do with me and everything to do with their own situation. And on the other side, if I'm lashing out at someone, it's something I haven't accepted in myself. What is it that I'm projecting onto another human being that I haven't resolved in my own life? That's where those frustrations, anger, sadness, or whatever. But if I just take the time to write about it, think about it, you know, it sounds slightly airy-fairy, but I always wonder, like, who shit on this for the first time so that we would all just pretend. Like, pretending is such a terrible way to live. And I think there's this, I just heard Jordan Peterson talk and he said, truth is an adventure. It might be turbulent as hell in the short term, but it's the most exciting option overall. And that if you're willing to speak it, he's like, that's what it's going to take to make any difference in this ever fucked up world.
Well, especially in this society, you're playing with fire if you try to bring that to the table. It's right. Not safe. It's not safe out there anymore.
Garrett, did you go back and do any kind of therapy or any kind of coaching to go back in your childhood? Because I was on a couples coaching retreat back in May, went to Ireland for 4 days. And what I realized, went with Phil McKernan, and big shout out to Phil. It was amazing. And what I did is we look back into our childhood and a lot of these stories. I'll give you a quick example. When I was 5 years old, I went to the store with my grandmother. She's Italian, didn't have any money. I wanted to buy these toy soldiers. She didn't have the money. She's like, you know, we'll come back later and buy them. I wanted them right then and there. Didn't buy them. Came home. I don't even remember if I bought them, but I remember that scarcity of like, if I don't get something right then and there. So in my adulthood, when I'd get emails, when something had to get done, it needed to get done right then and there. And then when I understood that childhood, and I don't want to call it a trauma, but every little thing that happens, they're not really huge traumas, but things that happen. Did you have somebody to help you out with your childhood? What I'm telling people that are listening, go back into your childhood, explore it, do the work, let those emotions sit with you and try to figure out why are you lashing out at your wife? Why are you making those stupid decisions on investing? Why are you a risk taker? Why are you a striver, miser, conservative, high roller? Why are you one of those? And once you realize that we're all built differently, we all have different experiences from our childhood that we bring over to the future. Did you do any work on that? What would you say to the listeners?
When I wrote Killing Sacred Cows, I really hadn't done any childhood work other than I did Landmark, which is ontological, and there's a little bit of work you do in your childhood, three specific moments, which was the first kind of peak. In 2019, I had hurt my shoulder, or I thought it was a physical injury. I'd been lifting, playing football with the kids, and all of a sudden I couldn't move the shoulder. I tried everything, dry needling, prolozone, stem cells. I went to a physical therapist. I got ultrasounds, x-rays, they couldn't find anything wrong. It turns out it was stored emotions that I had pushed into my shoulder. So it led me to somatic method with MDMA. And so I had 8 sessions with that. By the way, after the first session, full range of motion in my shoulder. But all of it went into the childhood situation. Then I did 40 years of Zen, which was about going and working through your brain and repatterning the program from past painful experiences in childhood and moving into theta rays while you're, so that was another experience that I did. And then I met this woman, Allison, and Allison went and she saw me and she's like, I could tell by your neurology, something happened with your birth. I'm like, how the hell could she tell this? So I go ask my mom, tell me about my birth. She's like, well, the cord wrapped around your neck, they had to palpitate you to resuscitate you. They ripped you out of my arms. I didn't hold you for 24 hours. And I'm like, oh, maybe that's where my abandonment issues and concerns come from. So I have done a lot of childhood, you know, going back and dealing with that from 2018 up until this day. And it's made all the difference in the world. And I actually wrote a book, Disrupting Sacred Cows, the sequel to Killing Sacred Cows. Because in Killing Sacred Cows, I didn't say where we adopt scarcity from, but most of our scarcity is from unprocessed pain, perceived trauma, and experience when our brain isn't developed as a child. And then we make this paradoxical promise that we'll never go through it again. And that promise, anytime something is a hint of that, we sabotage those moments. So once I cleared those, I processed that emotion and even let it out of my body, like I'm a different person. I am more loving. I am more aware of a lot of times when I'm projecting versus it's something that I haven't dealt with inside. I'm less of a people pleaser and I don't have a bunch of abandonment worries, which means I have a whole lot less scarcity, which allowed me to sell my company and not be identified with that and create something more aligned with who I am.
You're right in the book, scarcity breeds fear, and that fear causes us to make irrational decisions that limit rather than enhance our life. Scarcity allows us to see only limitations, suffering, poverty. When did you adopt that or start transitioning into more of an abundance mindset and leave that scarcity mindset? Any particular story or time in your life?
The first time I really remember it, like clearly, was there was this woman named Nancy, and I was a life insurance salesman back in the year 2000. And I won like this MDRT, rookie of the year type of thing, super proud of it, arrogant as hell. And I walked out and she saw me And she's like, congratulations. I can't wait till you get to the top of the table and you'll see they view money differently in the way they experience life. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, and I just trust her enough that I just started opening up and she's asking me questions. And I just have this like methodology that was very scarce when it came to how to handle money. Mm-hmm. Very savings oriented, very miserly of cutting back, reducing, scrimping, sacrificing, saving, delaying, deferring, that kind of whole reductionist kind of mindset. And at one moment in the conversation, she says, I wonder what it's like to live in the financial prison you built for your wife. I'm an asshole. Like, I realize we're living in an apartment. We can afford a house where, you know, she's a teacher, wants to buy stuff for her classroom. I'm telling her not to because she should get paid, not pay for. Like, just asking her why the heating bills so much, budgeting every dollar. Just like Dave Ramsey would have been proud as shit. You know, I was a total dick. And I just remember, like, it hit me so hard that I sat up against this pillar at the Venetian Hotel, scooted down and just started crying. And then the session lets out and all these people just see me crying as I'm now calling my wife. They think I'm happy because of the award. And I just told her, I've been an asshole. I am so sorry. Like, I think we should look for a home. I've been in such scarcity. It was a pivotal moment. And she accepted the apology. And now what's fucked up is my family's favorite pastime is to learn about who I was when I first married her until the time of that epiphany, because these are the stories. Hey, babe, your dad said we can move into the basement rent-free. She's like, sex-free if you think that's where I'm living, you know? Or I literally buy her a phone case that doesn't fit her phone because it's in a 99-cent clearance bin for her Christmas gift. And she's like, what is wrong with you? Patient woman. And that was the first moment. And then all of a sudden, now I had awareness of scarcity. So many people aren't even aware that they're being scarce. They just see it as their reality. So now I could see where are footprints of my life where I feel limitation, frustration, where I don't have the results that I want, where I don't believe something is possible. And anytime I would have anything that was, I can't, it's not, you know, any of those, I was like, ooh, this is scarcity. And I just asked different questions and I created a basically morning ritual where I took time to write. Like I wrote this morning in my little 5-minute journal, because I think gratitude is the gateway to abundance. And then intention is a big part of how we create more abundance as well. And I was taking time to meditate in the mornings, work out, you know, have some time to contemplate and write. And what happened is that was like putting on an armor of abundance each day, because now I was more aware of it, writing about emotions I had and how could I accept those? How could I forgive those? How could I love myself even through those? And so I do a lot of writing that's just for me, which I think if you compare Killing Sacred Cows to Money Unmasked, I hope that it's a much better written book, because I've spent all that time being more connected to myself, my emotions, and loving myself. So I'm able to say something with full transparency, honesty, instead of something that sounds academic.
The shadow personas. Let's talk about those four shadow personas. And I know you have the ones that have the abundance. So for anybody listening right now, I would write them down and try to identify with yourself which one you are. You may be multiple. You may not be. For me, it's when you said the saving. I mean, we both have, I think your family's part Italian. They're immigrants. Same with me. It was always about saving that dollar. Well, what are we saving it for? We're saving it for a rainy day that we're never going to spend it anyway because we don't want to touch our nest egg. It's very interesting that I was taught the very same way as you did in that scarcity. That's why when I read the book, I felt betrayed. I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing the same things he's doing. I'm getting the same results. So, kudos.
Yeah, my great-grandfather came over from San Giovanni in Fiore from southern Italy and left his wife, and who was pregnant, behind until he could have enough money to get her to come. It took 7 years. He met his daughter while she was 7 years old. He lived in a tent. Like, that amount of scarcity permeates into our family, that his daughter applied for welfare and they found $550,000 in her savings account. Like, but it's a mindset, right? Mm-hmm. So I grew up kind of with that. Like, I remember my aunt
was in the savings account or under the mattress.
Yeah, they actually literally, Jake, had money in coffee cans.
Yeah,
cash in coffee cans in the cellar. Like, yeah. My grandpa would show them to me, just cash, rolls of cash in these coffee cans. That was part of their money management philosophy for sure.
We had that too. Yeah.
Folgers or Maxwell House?
It was like,
yeah,
like,
yeah. And it was like they'd have been there for a while, rusty and shit. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's crazy.
Oh, memories.
So these personas, there's really four shadow personas: the miser, who plays a game called preservation. They'll end up with funds that they won't spend because they're simply afraid they're never going to have enough. They're addicted to holding on to what they got, right? Like they've got, they will spend 10 hours to save 10 bucks. Like that's the miser's mindset. They know where the cheapest gas is. They could calculate how much they save by buying something at Costco versus the grocery store. They'll work for double coupon days. They'll do everything they can. They'll borrow something even if they have a drive across town. Like they don't value their time enough. There's like, it's like a habit. Now the conservative is someone that plays a game called accumulation. Mm-hmm. And they'll end up with funds that's always about one day, someday in the future. They delay happiness. They delay gratification. They are more likely to put their money to work, though, in a diversified portfolio. They've been indoctrinated in reading, so they believe in index funds and the market and retirement plans, where the miser is a little bit more weary and scared of those things. And the conservative, the miser is pretty passive-aggressive. Like, they try to blend in. But if you risk them having to spend an extra dollar, like take them to a restaurant and you ordered more than them and you want to split the bill, they're going to fucking remember that forever.
And don't leave your wallet in the car. They're coming for you.
They got the alligator arms. Is that what you're saying?
Alligator arms, you know, short arms, deep pockets, that kind of stuff. So so both of those, the miser and the conservative, play not to lose, but play to win. Is kind of the striver who plays a game called status. They think they can work harder to make more money, but they inevitably burn out. You see a lot of entrepreneurs that are like this. That's the grind and the hustle. And the problem is playing to win is still a losing game because it's never about enjoying the present. It's always about one day, someday. But guess what? One day, someday never comes because even when they accomplish a goal, they've already created a bigger goal, so they never celebrate along the way. And they tell their family that they're doing it for their family and one day it's going to be different, but it never is because it's an addictive nature of workaholism. So mm-hmm. The final one is the high roller. You guys have met high rollers and these guys are dangerous in your world because high rollers play a game called opportunity and they take on far too much risk and it ends up, you know, with short-lived riches. And unfortunately, high rollers are fun, but they raise funds for deals that aren't real or deals that can't sustain or deals that haven't been vetted. Because they're so addicted to the conversation of wealth and the appearance of wealth that they don't actually sustain their wealth. So even if a deal hits, it has more to do with luck for a high roller than it has to do with skill, but they're really good at raising funds. So like they're dangerous to the other three personas more than
any other.
They
got lucky until the era of bridge debt came around in 2022, Gino, and then they got fucking schlacked.
Dude, I mean, like I remember my first real estate deal. My brother-in-law said, hey, I need some money for escrow. I gave him 25 grand. He gave me back 50 grand 3 months later. I'm like, well, that's a 400% annualized return. I didn't have anything to deal. I didn't listen to the deal. I had no skill in it. Then my buddy Joel's like, hey, dude, we got this deal. My buddy's falling behind on his payments. He's got a ton of equity. I think they're going to take the house from him. What if you buy it, then lease it back to him? He says he'll get his credit in order. When he buys it back from you, you'll split the equity. And if he defaults, you have a shit ton of equity. Well, no money down. I made 90 grand on that deal. No money down, 90 grand. Really good return. I had nothing to do. I just happened to be there and have good credit. And so those were my first two deals. I had another like few good deals. And then eventually I was like, I'm fucking so smart. I should just do so much real estate by never seeing the piece of real estate and partnering with people I think are smart. All those smart people weren't so smart in 2008. And then I got to inherit all the real estate. And I had to deal with it with the lack of intelligence, which then hijacked 2 years of my life in order to avoid bankruptcy and to do what I needed to do. And this is unfortunately how a lot of people, especially high rollers, operate. I was a striver saying, hey, I can make money and I'm just going to invest it with smart people. But I wanted actual real estate that you could touch. And the problem with that is, you know, we were doing really well until we weren't, and I wasn't involved enough. So the property managers weren't adequate. The property locations weren't ideal. And I sold most of it because I had to unload and lost most of the equity and was not a net positive because of that ignorance being confused for intelligence. Mm-hmm.
In your book, I love the story you talk about with your comedy shows and trying to sell out. I went to an event this weekend and one of the speakers said this phrase that really, really hit me in the nuts, Jake. And he basically said it's purpose over popularity. And everyone out there is trying to become as popular as possible, but there's not much purpose. There's not much meat behind what and substance behind it. And we're all, I guess, you know, part due to it. We all want to get more likes. We all want to get more views. When you're going through the comedy, you were struggling because you're trying to sell these shows out, but you weren't enjoying the process. Can you share that? And how did you overcome that?
Well, I had the best 5 months of my life from November 15th to April 15th because I wrote a comedy special. I rehearsed it every single day. I set up a comedy club in my basement. So from 5 to 6, Monday through Friday, I put on a show, sometimes on Zoom, sometimes in the basement. I'm walking around with my team and I'm writing every day. It was just an amazing experience. And then we culminated in filming this comedy special that had 8 Emmy winners on the crew. My executive producer had won an Emmy with, you know, Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld, and you know, George Carlin was his best man. It was like I was in so much joy. And then my manager was like, yeah, this is awesome, but now you should tour. Well, first off, most people tour, then do a comedy special. It was COVID, so I just prepared when the clubs were closed and then like did April 15, 2021. Like it was awesome because nobody had really seen each other and came together. And so I had just sold my company, so I didn't have this hundreds of thousands of people database. And now I'm going to go fill these clubs, which was me cashing in favors, hitting people up that are my friends, like schlepping in every possible way to promote this, which extracted and removed all the joy I had from comedy. Now, those nights were fun. Like out of the 16 plus cities, almost every date was sold out other than shows on Mondays. Shows on Mondays were a little tough to fill, but I, for a first time comedy tour, but I lost sleep. And I lost the joy of the process because someone else defined what I should do versus me defining it. Mm. I got trapped in the hustle and the grind and the notoriety and that I want to get this on Netflix. And if it's on Netflix, that makes me a real comedian. And I stopped the entire purpose of this is an expression of who I am. I mean, I want to use entertainment to educate. And now what I do is the second tour, I did a whole lot less cities, didn't worry about selling out every venue, had way more fun. And then I just get paid by corporations to come do it at their events, where there's already an audience. I had to redefine the game based upon my terms, not someone else's. And most people are living a life based upon someone else's terms. Their parents, their spouse, they're going through because this is what a teacher said. This is what they thought was going to be a good career, but it's not what they want to do. And when we live our life for someone else without knowing what we want, we suffer. And that suffering destroys the present. And that's why so many people look forward to retirement, because they hate what they do and how they live, and they think everything one day, someday is just going to flip and get better. But guess what? Social Security might not be around. Your investment accounts are probably going to be inadequate if you're just putting money in a 401k. And so everything that you were told is going to be a dream in retirement is a ream. That's why I call it the American ream. Because if we think that someone cares more about our money than we do, if we're just going to set it and forget it, invest early, often, and always, we're going to count on retirement plans and the government, we're going to find out that it's going to be a really disappointing road. And the best thing you could do is start to design your life today, which might take a lot of work to get educated. It might take a lot of work to build the right relationships. It might take a lot of effort to develop your skill sets. But if it's congruent with who you are, it's fucking worth it. That's the work that is enjoyable, even when it's difficult. What's hard is when you're doing something you hate, so it destroys your energy, and you don't even give a shit about it other than the paycheck. That is a recipe for destruction.
Purpose over popularity, Jake. Let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsors. Well, you nailed that story, brother. Thanks.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from 0 units to over $250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Build Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from 0 to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey multifamily.
All right, so we're back. I just want to get clear. Are you a full-time comedian now? Is that the full-time career?
I'm a full-time entertainer where comedy is part of it. But this also is part of it, as I was teasing and saying, I thought Jake could probably read this book since we know only Gino read my book.
I see the pictures. I just can't read it. Yeah. Though. I don't know what it says.
And that's but I want to use entertainment to educate. So I actually have a theatrical keynote where I play the four money personas as different characters in the keynote. And I actually pick up the guitar and take people through an exercise where they could feel abundance instead of just hear about it by making the shift in the exercise. And as a 45-year-old white man, I even rap at the end because why not? And so what I found is I want to take elements of entertainment and performance to educate. And so everything in my new company, FreeFlow, is how do we use entertainment to educate and engage people so they can have a transformative experience. So I'm kind of a full-time comedian, but I'm not the comedian that's going to go to clubs where people are just
saying, you're not touring a circuit, right? You're not going to like tour a circuit or something.
Yeah. No, but I have a contract right here for my comedy special to get distributed. And my plan is just to do more corporate gigs. You know, show up and I'm the entertainment and a little bit educational. And people can kind of say, we want all entertainment. We want it 50-50. So I've showed up at events and I'm teaching tax while I'm teaching, while I'm making them laugh with comedy. And I'm giving them that kind of weave of 50-50. And so even right now, I'm on my book tour for Money Unmasked. And I'm just about a third of what I'm saying from stage is making people laugh. And two thirds is the content behind it. So I kind of created a hybrid that worked for my life. Comedy clubs. It's a jacuzzi experience. They enjoy it for the moment. They go home. It doesn't really matter. And there's a lot of comedians out there. And I don't want to be on the road 300 days a year so I could have some streaming service that does, you know, where it's my comedy special. I want my comedy to matter. So I've written a book called Life After Debt. And that book is using humor through the whole time on this topic we're talking about here. Opt out of the system. Don't get deep into consumer debt to the point where you have no loans that produce any cash flow for you. And instead, like, I'm using humor to get people to think about it in a completely different way. And hopefully that'll be a book parents buy their kids when they're graduating, or because it's got pictures in it and it's funny. And so everything I'm doing is like, how do we reinvent this really boring industry, you know, of finance? And how do you do it in a way that I love doing it?
It's interesting because I was saying before we got on, I just saw Daniel Tosh, and the guy that came out before him was funny, but at times he was noticeably shaky. And to see a performer that's coming on a stage with Daniel Tosh, you think, oh, this guy's going to be, I mean, he was good, but there was these things that you start picking apart. And then Daniel Tosh started talking about how he deals with anxiety and these things. And at times he's like holding his arm across. You could just see the guy's visibly uncomfortable at times, even though he's crushing it. And it's just amazing that, you know, I think folks, you know, get out there and try sometimes. Because you look at Garrett, for example, maybe a comedian at heart, but he's reinventing himself. He's going out there. He's putting himself on stage. You never know until you put the work in. And I think, Gino, you can speak to this as well as we've grown and we've done different, you know, live events and things. If you're sitting back and you want to do it, just put yourself out there. Because gang, I'm telling you, from even this last show that I saw, these guys were great, but you could tell they were uncomfortable. You're not born with this stuff. So give yourself a break. And
that makes
yourself.
It fun.
Yeah.
The growth. So I couldn't remember the last time I was really nervous speaking. And then we went to Italy in 2017. Gino, you'd appreciate it. We spent the summer. Well, 63 days, so pretty close to the summer. And when I came back, I was telling some jokes to my wife at a baseball game. And she's like, that's kind
of
funny.
Is she sick of the jokes yet?
Well, this is her mistake, because when I told those jokes at the baseball game, she goes, that's kind of funny. I translated that to, I'm a comedic god. That's what I heard. I'm a comedic god.
To me, I hear you actually made one funny for once.
Right? Yeah. And making my wife laugh, that's the hard job, right?
No doubt.
So then I go speak at my buddy's event that Sunday, first time I'd spoken in months. And he's like, oh, our next speaker is fucking hilarious. And I was like, what? I'm giving a 40-minute financial talk. So I just told some jokes and they laughed. And this is my formula. Anytime something scares me and excites me at the same time, I it's like a four-part structure. I walk off stage. I call, who do I know that could be a co-creator? Someone that can support, inspire me, because I want to go do a stand-up gig. So I call my buddy Marcus. He was running up on Last Comic Standing. I'm like, dude, I have an idea. I look like Jesus. I just don't have his powers. I think we could write a comedy bit around it. I want to practice with you. He showed up in my office the next day from 5 to 7 p.m. My youngest was there laughing hysterically as we were telling these jokes. That Wednesday, I invited 6 rows of friends, so I couldn't back out, to the open mic. And I got up and I did 4 minutes and 20 seconds. And Marcus was like, that shit was good. Open for me. So I always look for a co-creator with a new idea. Then the second thing is, I have to go through and eliminate things. What in my life would distract me from doing the new thing I want to do? For me, it was easy at that time because I was like, well, I've been in Italy. I'm going to remove watching any sports for this next while. I mean, shit, it was It was August, sports in August, not great. So that was easy. Sports talk radio, easy, you know, just a couple things like that. So I created some space. And then the third thing is I delegate. Like, what is it I have to delegate in my life permanently so I can have even more space, which is delegate a role to someone. So I do a 5 and 5. What are 5 things I want to do more of, 5 things I want to do less of, so I can shift that. And this content creation, comedy is one of them. And then the fourth one is collaboration. So you got to realize collaboration made me where I did my first comedy gig in 2017, August 2017. I'm opening for my friends August of 2019. And an agent's in the room and he goes, it was probably my best set I'd done to that point in my life. It was in an auditorium, so people are all around. And he's like, dude, nobody's done this in money. I want to represent you. So I thought about it for a couple of months. I said, okay, but it still took a year of like, he brought in a writer for Chris Rock, this guy Lance that worked with me. And then I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to start talking about a special. Then that collaboration took it where we had all these Emmy winners for sound, for camera, for set design. You know, we had an Emmy winner editor. We had a multi-Emmy winner executive producer. We had a director that did one of Tasha's comedy specials. Like, so that collaboration took it far beyond what I could have imagined in 2017, in 2021. So 4 years later, that collaboration taught me how to do comedy better, put me an accelerated path. But most people don't call that co-creator that creates accountability. So if you call that one person that's not mom who says, oh, you can do anything, sweetie, you want someone that's like, okay, how can we get you to do this? So if I'm writing a book, when I wrote Money on Mass, I called AJ Harper, who is an editor who's brilliant, right? I'm like, I need a good editor to bounce ideas off of. So if you find that co-creator, it'll take that next step to kind of get you what you want. And if you're scared, when I walked off that stage after that open mic, I pissed 3 or 4 times before I went on stage, because when you're that nervous, those other functions kind of go away. And when I walked off that stage,
did anyone care that you had like the stain on your pants?
On my pants? No, I knew you were going there, dude. I knew that's where you would go. So it was only because I didn't shake it. It was just a little. No.
So the khakis are brutal to that, you know.
Yeah. So when I left that stage, it was euphoric, and my wife could see in my eyes, like, she's like, damn, this is going to be something you do. I'm like, no, baby, it's just a hobby. But she knew. Because comedy took me back to being 5 years old, listening to my uncles tell jokes and my mom laughing hysterically. My dad always having this sense of humor that everybody loved and talked about. So comedy felt like love. And that creation was loving in action. And when someone's laughing, they're not worried about the past or scared of the future. They're with you in that moment. And every time someone laughs, it resets the energy. And it gets them to like, and in the old days I would speak, I'm super intense, people come talk to me. But after I do speaking with comedy, I just spoke in Florida to 2,000 chiropractors, 4 hours of signing books. There was a line that they said was almost a mile long from the 2,000 people coming up, because comedy connects in a way that nothing else I've ever seen can. So that's why comedy, I can get a message out there in a way I couldn't have before. I mean, we could make fun of Big Pharma, which they deserve. Or which is better than just yelling about him. I think that it's a little bit of both, right?
I like it. I'll be your co-creator. and I like the way you approached it too. I mean, you're delegating, you're putting systems in place, you're hiring the right coaches and team. I mean, that's fantastic. That's going to lead to success as well. Taking it back to the business side, anything that you've read or any type of education that you've done outside of the comedy in the last year or so that has added value to your life that you want to share with the folks?
I don't read a lot because I write a lot. Yeah. And I have fascinating conversations like this where I do a lot of my learning, and my wife is she reads and researches and fills me in. So, you know, kids, the way you succeed is you stop reading. That's my advice. Like,
No worries there. So, going back to the comedy stuff, you know, tell us what's next, what kind of project you're working on there, and the hub for all things Garrett Comedy right now.
So on the comedy side, I've been writing Life After Debt, but it probably won't come out for a couple of years. I'll have a book and a comedy special. We need American.
What do you do with these comedy specials? Just so I know, like, are they on your website? Like, how do people access this stuff?
Well, the only way people can get it right now is if they buy Money on Mass. We're bonusing the comedy special.
Got it. That's the only way. Dude, yeah.
And then after a certain point, we're going to have to take it down because it'll be distributed by Multicom, who's a distributor that gets it on the different stations. And so we'll find out where they get it, who picks it up, who takes it. But you'll see it somewhere on one of your devices. And when people go to log in, they'll see when it moves on to that. But yeah, that's the only way to see my comedy right now. I haven't really gone in the social media route. Maybe I will. It's just a matter of, you know, the popular versus purpose that you mentioned. Like, I don't like to interrupt a lot of my process to go put something online. If I find the right team that can do it easily, I would do that. But right now I have a YouTube channel where I'm doing serious stuff in the financial world. Other than this is how I'm adding comedy to that, two ways. I love to roast. I love roasting people. So I've been meeting with people to get me with influencers where I can roast them about their stuff and then ask them about their worst financial decisions and their worst financial advice and then pitch my book. So that's how I'm going to integrate comedy in that. But I also am doing reaction videos. People send me videos of dumb financial ideas and dumb financial people, and I'm kind of roasting them on the fly. So I'll be using comedy on my YouTube channel a little bit. But for the most part, it's just like I'm right when this
ends. We have
ends,
plenty of content that you can just tear apart, by the way. So have at it. All right. Yeah.
I'm going straight to do a comedy gig right after this. Like I'll walk. I'm at this hotel. I'm going to go do it for a group of entrepreneurs. So a lot of times when I speak, like, I roast the people that I speak for. I roasted Joe Polish. I don't know if you know Dan Martell, who just wrote Buy Back Your Time. I roasted him. I roasted Ron Carson, who's a, you know, Carson Wealth Group's massive organization. Like, in front of 2,000 people, I roasted him. I love Yannick Silver. Like, I've roasted so many people that you guys probably know. And so that's a good way I'm using comedy.
I got his book that he sent me right here because I journal in this.
We've interviewed most of them. So, yeah.
Those guys.
I should send you all the roasts. I'll send you all the roasts I've done of them, because anyone that writes a book, they roast themselves in the book. Like, some of the people changed the next edition of their book based upon my roast, because I just hammered certain things about them in their book. Yeah.
And so what's the hub? Where can people get all things Garrett Comedy here?
Moneyunmasked.com. They can go there. They can get the bonus comedy gift when they buy the book, some really cool money persona tools that we've added in there. And you can even find out your money persona and take it. If you share it with three people, you get a free copy. You get my $500 digital course on everything around the concepts of the book: cycle of creation, how to recover cash, how to win and play, which is design your winning game, all the money persona stuff. So that's kind of a cool concept too. And then GarrettGunderson.com. I think it's 2006, so I started a blog, and I actually write it. ChatGPT hasn't written a single word of it, so you can check things out there.
You're working too hard, man.
I am, but I love to write. I love to write, though. So some people are like, have you ever tried ChatGPT for jokes? I'm like, did you ever ask ChatGPT to fuck your wife? Like, why would I take out the fun part? Like, not everything's meant to be efficient. You know what I'm saying? Like, some things are nice just to be satiating experiences.
We were at an event, and one of the guys was walking around with his laptop, and he gave it to me, and it scared the shit out of me. And then I went home, and I'm like, should I get on it? Should I not? Like, I'm really afraid of this stuff. So I went and logged on. I went on and tried to get it, but they asked for a login. And the minute anything asked me for a login, it's just straight shut down. I never went back. So I don't even have exposure to it. Gino, you're up. Hit it.
Jake, you know, reading Killing Sacred Cows, to me, honestly, was one of the most pivotal books that I read early on in my journey. Because I'll say it again, I felt betrayed. I felt lied to. And I'm glad that I read that, because I started asking questions. I think we need to question everything. Even 20, 30 years ago, you know, everyone says, let's go back to the good old times. The good old times were not the good old times. They were just the good old hidden times. You know, they had their own agenda. And I think what the book really talks about is the abundance mindset, the scarcity mindset. That opened my mind up to not just being that person saving for my retirement, really saved by these assets. And this book that I've read, Money Unmasked, there's so many different value propositions within the book. We didn't touch about the different matrices. We didn't talk about net worth and cash flow, because that's what you do. You pick up the book, you read the book at your own leisure, take notes when you're reading the book. And I love it that a guy who's in insurance ended up being a comedian. That's the true comedy right there. I just, like, how many people in insurance there? It is the most one of the most industries that I just keep doing the same thing over and over again. And you have such an opportunity to bring clarity to people, to
with
make it enjoyable, to be
fun.
Like zero, like less than zero. So listen, I commend you for the job you're doing. Keep pushing the boundaries, keep growing, and keep writing books, because you keep writing books, I'll keep buying the books, my friend.
All right, great, man. Thank you for buying my books. I love writing them. Yeah, that's good. Jake, when you learn to read, we'll get them off to you, but I'll let you know when the audiobook comes out.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think of decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy. And that's the funny man, Garrett. We'll see you next time.